Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the fourth forum and the final event in the 2017 Leon Panetta Lecture Series. And if you're wondering why there isn't somebody prettier up here, Sylvia pulled a muscle in her back. And for those of you that are familiar with what that means, you know why she's not here. But she did want me to extend her regards, and she's doing well. As we said at our first lecture in March, this year is our 20th anniversary. And as this milestone season comes to a close, I in particular want to thank all of you that have come here and attended these lecture forums. We appreciate your support, and we appreciate your being here. This spring, we've been exploring the Trump presidency. When we selected this theme, we knew that the new administration would bring a very different approach to Washington and to policy. But no one quite anticipated the number and scope of challenges that the White House is facing both here and abroad. In the world, we are seeing a number of dangerous threats. Threats that we have probably not seen since the end of World War II. This spring alone, we've seen a sharp increase in terror attacks, particularly with the tragic events in London, in Baghdad, in Afghanistan. There's a growing aggression from North Korea. There are failed states like Syria and the Middle East that are breeding grounds for terrorism. There are the continuing threats from Iran. The threat of a new arms race and cyber attacks interfering with our election in this country from Russia. Instability in Europe as a result of the Brexit vote, and another vote coming up in Great Britain. And a China growing in strength and influence and continuing to make territorial claims in the South China Sea. It is within this environment that President Trump has assumed leadership of the world's only remaining superpower. His recent decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement is just the most recent example that President Trump is transforming America's relationships with traditional allies and testing the strength of longstanding commitments. How does the concept of America First translate into foreign policy? What will be the impact on the global community, on the peace and security of our country, if America does not provide leadership on issues like the fight against terror, on nuclear proliferation, on the protection against cyber threats, and on climate change? Tonight, we'll ask these questions to two of the most experienced foreign policy, national security, and defense experts of our time. Our first guest is a pioneer in foreign policy and global affairs. She served in both Bush administrations. She was in President George H.W. Bush's National Security Council. She was on their staff. She held several positions, including director and senior director of Soviet and East European Affairs. She was special assistant to the president for national security affairs. She joined the administration of President George W. Bush in 2001 as his national security advisor. The first woman to hold that position, she served in that capacity until 2005, when she was confirmed as the 66th Secretary of State, becoming the second woman and the first African-American woman to hold that post. In these roles, she pioneered a policy of transformational diplomacy and heralded the formation of new global governments based on democratic principles. She has authored and co-authored numerous books, including Extraordinary Ordinary People, A Memoir of Family, No Higher Honor, A Memoir of My Years in Washington, and her recent bestseller, Democracy, Stories from the Long Road to Freedom. She earned her BA, her master's, and her PhD, all from the University of Denver, and currently is a professor at Stanford University. Ladies and gentlemen, we are honored to welcome Condoleezza Rice. Our second guest used his vast experience in national security, technology, and innovation to defend the United States for more than 35 years. He served as an Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy from 1993 to 1996, and was Under Secretary of Defense for Acquisition, Technology, and Logistics from 2009 to 2011. In 2011, when I became Secretary of Defense, I chose him to become my Deputy Secretary of Defense. Working as the Pentagon's Chief Operating Officer, overseeing the department's annual budget and its 3 million-plus civilian and military personnel. Named the 25th Secretary of Defense in 2015, he became known for his leadership and his creativity. He energized the global military campaign against ISIS, designed and executed a strategic pivot to the Asia-Pacific region, established DOD and NATO's new strategy for confronting Russian aggression. He spearheaded revolutionary improvements in technological and operational capabilities, and he launched the latest DOD cyber strategy. For his work, he's been awarded the Department of Defense's Distinguished Service Medal, the highest DOD civilian honor on 5 separate occasions. He earned his BA from Yale University and his PhD from Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. We are honored to welcome Ash Carter.
Thanks, Cal. Thank you. Welcome. Madam.
Mr. Secretary.
And of course, the moderator of this program is Leon Panetta. Good evening again, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. Hey, I'm playing a different role. Welcome again to our fourth and final forum of the lecture series, the Leon Panetta Lecture Series for 2017. As you know, we've had this theme, the Trump presidency and the future of America. We've talked about healthcare, we talked about the economy. Last week we talked about our democracy. Tonight we focus on the world and a number of dangerous threats that face us in today's world. And the issue that we'll focus on is whether the United States will continue to provide what it has done for the last 70 years since World War II, to continue to provide global leadership in that kind of world? Or will we retreat into Fortress America? The dangers that are out there are indeed significant in the sense of which one of these could have us in confrontation from day to day. We are dealing with terrorism and dealing with ISIS and their attacks. We're dealing with all of these failed states in the Middle East. We're dealing with the threat from Iran. We're dealing with Russia. We're dealing with China. We're dealing with North Korea. We're dealing with wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we're dealing with cyber, the new battlefield of the future. In dealing with all of those threats, do we do this alone? Or do we do this by building relationships and alliances with our allies throughout the world? That's the kind of issue that we will discuss this evening with two, as I said, very experienced and knowledgeable individuals, both in foreign policy as well as in defense. Let me begin, obviously, by talking about some of the recent events that we've seen happen in both foreign policy and defense policy. We've had these terrible attacks in London. We had the president's 9-day trip abroad. We've had the withdrawal from the Paris Accords. We continue to have his tweets on the travel ban and criticizing the mayor of London. We've also had H.R. McMaster and Gary Cohen, who are members of the administration, who wrote in the Wall Street Journal, and I quote, "The world is not a global community, but an arena where nations, non-governmental actors, and businesses engage and compete for advantage," unquote. David Brooks called that, in his column, "Selfishness is the sole driver of human affairs." Is that true? How would you define Trump's foreign policy? And have we come to an end of the 70-year era of U.S. global leadership? Let me start with you, Condi.
All right, I drew the short straw. Okay. Well, first of all, thanks very much for having us here and to the Panetta Institute for all that you do. So let me start with the issue of American global leadership and the view that the world is a kind of jungle in which everybody competes for advantage. Well, to a certain extent, yes, the notion of an international community has always been something of a fiction. There are countries that are pursuing their interests and pursuing them to the limits that they possibly can. That is absolutely true. The people, though, who designed the system after World War II looked back on the world between World War I and World War II, and they said, no, we're not going to do that again. That was zero-sum game. It was a zero-sum game international economy in which people protected, in which you had beggar-thy-neighbor trading policies, you had violent competition over resources. We can do better. And they created a global order with an international economy that was actually not to be zero-sum game. It was to be one in which everybody, through comparative advantage, could win, and the international economy would grow. It wasn't a fixed pie with everybody just getting their piece. They also had a vision of free peoples as people who would be peaceful peoples. So when they rebuilt Germany, they rebuilt it as a democracy. Japan as a democracy, it's paid off handsomely. And so the American concept of the global order was, yes, it was competitive, but it didn't have to be conflictual. And there could be institutions that helped countries to cooperate. I think in the long run, that is in America's interest. It is in America's interest to have allies. It is in America's interest to work with others toward common goals. Of course, we have to defend our interests. But we've always believed that we can defend our interests and our values in concert with others, not necessarily against others, particularly those who share our values. As to the Trump foreign policy, I think it's still evolving. I think it's still emerging. If you look at some of the policies, they're pretty traditional. We've gone back to a one China policy, for instance, after the president wasn't so sure that he believed in one China. Well, we've now restated that. We will get to this, but I think the North Korea policy looks like the North Korea policy would look whoever's in the White House. The Syria policy is one that's actually a little bit now defending the red line that President Obama set. And even the trip to NATO, where there were clearly some missing words in the pledge to an attack upon one is an attack upon all, Article 5, even that trip still demonstrated a president going to NATO, a president saying that this alliance is important to us. So let's see how it evolves. We all know the members of that national security team. They are all extremely capable people, Rex Tillerson at State, Jim Mattis at Defense, H.R. McMaster. And so while some of the notes to the music sound a little bit different, I'm sincerely hoping that ultimately the score will be much the same, because I think that American leadership for 70 years has served us extremely well.
Ash?
Oh, I agree with that last part. And just to add to what Condi said, it is important that we stand for things, and we do. But even if you're just thinking about how we get what we want, you get what you want not only with competitive behavior. We also get what we want through cooperative behavior, and alliances are a good example of that. And it's fine to question alliances, and people ought to question alliances, but to certainly from the point of view of national defense, they are ways of bringing more firepower and more geography into a circumstance than we would have on our own. And so they add value to us. And Leon, you started out by talking about a fortress America, and there's a fallacy in that concept in my mind. In today's world, there is no such thing as it being in America is not a fortress. Once upon a time, the oceans and the heavens constituted a fortress, but in the missile age and the cyber age, that's no longer the case. So we are, in fact, not only less effective, but fundamentally incapable of defending ourselves without some cooperation with at least some part of the world. And I think as far as the new administration is concerned, and the president and President Trump, if we're gonna get whatever it is we want over time, clarity and consistency are so important. And that's why Condi's point about consistency, and much of our policy has been consistent over decades and administrations. And that's where we've been most effective. NATO was effective. NATO defended Europe and ended the Cold War. And then it was been effective in Afghanistan. It's actually done things over time. But you need clarity and you need consistency. And to Condi's point about hearing different things from different people, I think the lack of clarity is what I hear most from those overseas. I said, one minute I hear one thing from Jim Mattis, or this from Rex Tillerson, but the next minute there's a tweet. And at some point over those need to come together, because without that clarity and consistency, we're not going to get what we want.
Connie, let me ask you just on the Paris Accords, which was obviously a controversial decision. And there's a new poll out, I think, where 60% of the American people were opposed to withdrawing from that agreement. But you were there when President Bush withdrew from the Kyoto agreements as well. What are the consequences of withdrawing from the Paris Accords?
Well, we did withdraw from Kyoto. We didn't do it very elegantly, by the way. And it shows that early on, White Houses tend to be a bit chaotic. I don't care who is there. Even if it's somebody who was governor of Texas and was the president's son at one point, they can be a little bit chaotic. But Kyoto was a very different accord. First of all, Kyoto was a set of targets that had been set by the international community. And everybody was supposed to meet them. Secondly, it had gone down 99 to nothing in a Senate resolution, so it had really no domestic support. And very clearly, getting out of Kyoto had some cost, but I think it was a different kind of agreement than the Paris Accord. The Paris Accord, which, by the way, we need to be careful about apocalyptic language. The Paris Accord was never going to stop climate change and global warming. The United States has, over the last decades, had reversing emissions, and so we have lower emissions. China and India are going to continue to add to the emissions for some time, even under the Paris Accord. But what the Paris Accord was, it was a kind of international ratification of national plans to deal with climate change. And in that regard, I think it had some value, and I would have preferred to see us stay in. It's a national plan for the United States anyway. If we believed that there needed to be adjustments in terms of economic growth, then those adjustments could have been made effectively unilaterally. And I think the cost is that you appear to be saying, we'll go it alone. Now, what I hope is that the United States will now continue to do what we've been doing, which is to find a formula for economic growth, environmental stewardship, and changing energy mix so that we're getting more alternatives in. We're going to be dependent on hydrocarbons for a long time. But we've been on this path. We can continue on this path. Now, one thing that I think is kind of laughable, frankly, and I'll put it very strongly, the idea that China is now going to become the leader in this area. Have you tried to breathe in Beijing recently? So we sometimes use language that makes a mockery of a serious point. And if Xi Jinping wants to clean up China, more power to him. I hope he'll do it rapidly, because for the Chinese people and the rest of the world, China needs to stop emitting. China needs to stop building coal-fired plants every week. And that's what they're doing. So again, I would have stayed in. I don't like the apocalyptic language around it. But I think the cost is that people think you're saying you're going it alone.
Ash, let me ask you about defense policy. As you know, he's appointed a number of former military types, many of whom we work with, H.R. McMaster and Jim Mattis, mm-hmm. who was head of CENTCOM when I was there, John Kelly, who was my military aide. He's also appointed, as Connie pointed out, other responsible people like Pompeo, Dan Coats, in their intelligence positions, in addition to Rex Tillerson. And he has conducted the limited attack in Syria, as you pointed out, brought the Arab coalition together to fight ISIS. It's been a lukewarm attitude with regards to NATO. But he's strongly supported funds for defense. Is there a difference between U.S. defense policy under President Obama and under President Trump?
Well, let me start with the defense first part, and the defense part first, and the budget. He's made about a 3% proposed increase. Of course, there is no budget, which is a whole other story. But we haven't had a budget in 8 years. All the time I was Undersecretary of Defense, Deputy Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Defense, the Congress hasn't, we've lived on continuing resolutions, the Congress hasn't had a normal budget cycle in all that time. And so whether there'll ever be a budget or not, I don't know. But if it is and it's his, it'll be 3% larger. I won't tell you that as Secretary of Defense, I don't think we could make good use of another 3%. It's not a huge amount. But I think we could. At the same time, as Secretary of Defense, I was not and didn't believe I could be indifferent to the functions that contributed to our defense that are outside of the Department of Defense. Condi, you know, and her Department of State, case one, much of the intelligence effort, the Energy Department, which supports us with nuclear weapons, which is critical to our security, in my judgment, the law enforcement, the FBI, if you talked about terrorist attacks and so forth. So there are a lot of functions that are not in defense that are necessary for protecting ourselves. And finally, I believe that in the long run, Leon, the nation's strength depends on research and development, education. And so I didn't think as Secretary of Defense I could be indifferent to all the other parts of the government as well, even if I did believe that we could spend, and we're spending, not to my satisfaction all the time, but in an improving way, the money that we have. And as far as continuity of defense policy is concerned, you mentioned the counter-ISIL campaign. The counter-ISIL campaign is basically the campaign that we embarked on a year and a half ago, 2 years ago. You see it unfolding. It was Mosul. It was Raqqa. Mosul will fall shortly. Raqqa will fall. Those are essential because it is necessary to destroy ISIL where it arose and to destroy the fact and the idea that there can be a state based upon this ideology. That is necessary. It's not sufficient because you still have homegrown people and inspired people and people in other parts of the world, but it is necessary to get that done. That is continuing, and I'm very pleased, I'm extremely pleased at that. That's good because I don't know a good alternative or I would have proposed it. I hope that everyone continues to, I used to use the word accelerate, to accelerate it. Anytime we think of another way of doing things, we ought to go on and do that. There's one last thing. I just saw Jim Mattis out at the Shangri-La Dialogue out in the Pacific, and John McCain, who gave a speech in Sydney, Australia. Before that's exactly what I would say. And not only that, that's exactly what American presidents and secretaries of state and secretaries of defense have said for decades, which is the Asia Pacific is peaceful and prosperous, and that's not an accident. It happened because of the pivotal role that American military power played in that region, and we need to keep that going. So there's continuity. Now, I can't be sure that that'll keep up. As Condi says, it's early in the administration. You don't know. But I certainly hope it does, because I know that those are the right things to do for our country and our security.
Condi, let me pick up on something Ash talked about. In the president's budget, you know, I think he adds about $54 billion to defense, but he cuts dramatically foreign aid and the State Department. So you have this whole issue of our, you know, of military and diplomacy. I think it was Jim Mattis that said, if you're gonna cut diplomacy, you better buy me more bullets. What's your reaction to the cuts?
Well, as we know, this is an opening bid. As a matter of fact, it's more of a statement than it is a budget. And this is going to be an iterative process with the Congress. And I doubt very seriously that the budget's going to look this way when it actually comes out. On the State Department side, obviously, I don't think the cuts at the levels that they are in that piece of paper are possible. I will say, though, that the State Department could use some reorganization and reform. I've never seen an organization that couldn't. I was Stanford's provost, and that meant I was the budget officer. And people were always horrified when you said we're actually going to have to make some cuts in budget. Just as an example, State Department now appears to be about 75,000 people. That's about 15,000 more than when I was there. So I've kind of wondered what's happened in that number. I also think that there are probably some, you know, just management things. When I became Secretary of State, we had 70 phone contracts, 7-0. I said, there aren't 70 providers. How can we have 70 phone contracts? Well, everybody had their own little phone. So I'm sure there are a lot of things. And Rex Tillerson, who was an outstanding CEO as head of Exxon and had to watch costs, can do a lot. Now, that said, I hope that this will be done with a scalpel, not with a cudgel, because there are some very important programs. Some to support the state building in places where we're trying to keep terrorists out, because you can push the terrorists out, but if things don't calm down in terms of governance and the economy, they will be back the next week. Some of it is related to helping countries that are trying to be more democratic, which, by the way, the more democracies, the better. Democracies don't fight each other. Democracies don't send child soldiers into battle as young as 10 years old. They don't harbor terrorists. They don't traffic women into the sex trade. And so some of the programs are that. But in many ways, our most amazing programs are ones that show American compassion. like AIDS relief, where we've saved millions of people from a pandemic in Africa. Malaria relief, where we've saved. America is a powerful country, but we've always been also a compassionate country, mm-hmm. and we need to show that. Now, when you ask most Americans, they've done these polls, people think as much as 25 or 26% of the federal budget goes to foreign assistance. In fact, it is less than 1.5%, and about half of that 1.5% goes to so-called strategic policy, like supporting Israel and Egypt and the like. So I would not be one who said, don't look at the budget. Just one other little point, when I became secretary, we had as many foreign service officers in Germany as we had in India, and which one with 1 billion people, one with 80 million people, because the epicenter of the Cold War had been Germany. So there's lots you can do to make the State Department more efficient and so forth. But if you cut some of these programs that have ultimately made us safer because they've created decent governments elsewhere, we are going to be getting more bullets because we're going to have more trouble in the world.
Okay, this is the pitch for the book.
Thank you.
Democracy, it's a bestseller, and in it, you conclude that the work of democracy is not done, and that we have to work to make our democracy truer and just for us, but we also have to make it truer and just for all mankind, yeah. Humankind. Unfortunately, we live at a time that you also point out where we have the so-called four horsemen of the apocalypse: populism, nativism, protectionism, isolationism, that are still riding around in parts of the world. So how can you promote democratic principles in a world where there is this backlash?
Well, the first thing is to recognize, or to state loudly, that democracy is a superior form of government. It is the only form of government, by the way, where you can change your leaders peacefully. That's why authoritarians are frightened of their own people. As I said, the democracies tend to behave better in the world. And ultimately, if we believe that these values are universal, endowed by a creator, we're either living a lie or they actually should be universal for others too. And I experienced this as a kid. Maybe one reason I'm so attracted to this and so powerfully defensive of democracy is I grew up in segregated Birmingham, Alabama, where my parents couldn't take me to a movie theater or to a restaurant. We were second-class citizens. And I remember a particular afternoon, I was coming home from school with my Uncle Alto, and I was about six-ish. And it was election day in Alabama. And this man named George Wallace was on the ballot to become governor of Alabama. And there were long, long lines of black people voting. And I said to my uncle, well, in my own six-year-old way, I knew that George Wallace wasn't good for black people. So I said, well, if all those people are voting, he can't possibly win. And my uncle said, no. He said, we're still a minority, and he's going to win. And I looked at my uncle and I said, so why do they bother? And my uncle said, because they know that one day that vote will matter. Now, as I went around the world and I saw people standing in line in Afghanistan and Iraq and Liberia, and they know that one day that vote will matter. And so our promotion of democracy is a moral cause as well as a practical one. And by the way, I've heard this, you can't impose democracy. You impose tyranny. There are few people in the world who would say they don't want to be able to say what they think, worship as they please, be free from the knock of the secret police at night, and choose those who would govern them. And we're not saying, let's impose that on others. We're saying to leaders who don't govern democratically, don't impose your will on your own people. And so I prefer the word democracy, the words democracy support to democracy promotion, because sometimes it's just all the time, it's just supporting those people who are trying to gain the same rights that we have.
Let me follow up on that with a reflection of what you're saying. Obviously occurred with the Arab Spring. Ash, you and I were in the administration when the Arab Spring occurred, and you had countries, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, all were acting to try to take down tyrannies within their own countries. But the result in most cases were failed states. And those failed states have now become breeding grounds for terrorists. I guess the question to both of you, let me start with Ash. How could the U.S. have handled it better to avoid that kind of tragedy in terms of how these failed states develop?
Well, it is kind of the question of the last 15 years, because most of our military involvements, most of our troops who died or wounded in those kinds of wars, they're actually kind of various. Some of them were at our initiative. Others were where a situation was deteriorating anyway. And others, like Afghanistan, was just pure self-defense initially. So it's different. But I think the general answer to your question, Leon, is you do understand. I had a good friend of mine, the Israeli defense minister, Bugi Yalom, who said to me, it's easy to make an omelet out of an egg, but it's impossible to make an egg out of an omelet. And in other words, when you take a society apart in the process of democratization, which can be a desirable way to go, and you create the failed state, or you create a situation that is lawless, it can be impossible to recover from that. Now, we're getting a lot better at that, I think, not just the military, but the State Department and others at helping people make that transition. But I think you have to go in with a very realistic perspective, which is it is a long-term commitment. It is one that is best if you have others working with you, because they multiply the resources and they do less to focus the population on the idea that this is an American thing. So all those are good, but we've learned a lot over the last 15 years. But I do think one has to look at these things with caution, because it's so hard to put the egg back together.
Condi.
Yeah, let me pick up on something Ash said and say it a little bit, maybe a little bit differently. Iraq and Afghanistan were not democracy promotion. Iraq and Afghanistan were security issues that we tried to solve by military force. Iraq, we were wrong about the weapons of mass destruction, but he had been a cancer in the region, had invaded his neighbors. We thought it was time to deal with him. Afghanistan was pure self-defense, deal with the safe haven for al-Qaeda after 9/11. I would never have said to President Bush, let's use American military power to bring democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan. That would have been a misuse of American military power. You used American military power to deal with the security issue. Now, once you have overthrown the Taliban and Saddam Hussein for security reasons, you have to make a choice, because you now have responsibility to those countries. And it's the worst of circumstances, because these tyrannical cult of personalities, there's nothing underneath. There are no institutions underneath. Same with Libya, with the overthrow of Gaddafi. And so we decided in Afghanistan and Iraq that we were best off to try to give them a chance to build a democratic state. But it's a long process. It's very hard, particularly when there are no institutions, because the Saddam Husseins of the world don't allow institutions to be created under them. You know, totalitarian regimes, totalitario, which is Mussolini's name, word for it. Think of Joseph Stalin's Russia, Soviet Union. Prokofiev and Shostakovich are persecuted for not writing music that's socialist enough. There is not a single part of the life of the country that isn't serving the state. So these are extremely stressing cases. Now, if you look at the Arab Spring, two things come to mind. First of all, Tunisia has done better than others. And there's a reason for that. Tunisia had institutions that were ready to take over when this democratic opening came. They had a nationwide labor movement, for instance. They had a strong civil society of women's groups. So the Islamists in Tunisia had to compete and work with other groups And that's why Tunisia doesn't look like Egypt. Mubarak in Egypt had destroyed all liberal forces. So of course the only organized forces were the Muslim Brotherhood, which then tried to have a democratic coup. So my point is these are very different circumstances, mm-hmm. but there's one lesson. It's going to be a lot easier if there are some kinds of institutions in place when this opening comes. And part of the work of democracy building is to start before the democratic opening comes. Help parties to develop. Help a free press to develop. Help women's groups to develop. You get better results when that opening comes. But one reason I wanted to write about this was Americans have become extremely allergic to the idea of democracy promotion because we associate it with Afghanistan and Iraq. Yeah. Most of it is not at all like that. And that I hope we will take into our future efforts.
And that's where the term nation building came in. And, right. But the fact is, helping to establish those institutions is critical to what you just said.
It is critical and hard.
Okay, but before I go into some of these flashpoints that are around the world, and we'll do it with the questions from the audience, I did want to ask about, you know, none of us have served with presidents who tweet.
No, thank goodness.
But you said in the book, and I think it's true, that words matter, no matter how you say it. How can the United States implement some kind of consistent foreign policy when a president tweets his personal thoughts out to the world? How do you deal with that?
Well, it's really hard. Look, the president is going to use social media because he believes it's in his interest to do so. I hope that on the foreign policy side, there's a recognition, and you've seen it some on the foreign policy side, that if the president is going to use that medium, it needs to be strategic. Do it when you have something that you want to say to move policies forward, to influence others, and that takes a certain discipline that is not yet there, but might still get there. But if I can just say, it's not just the president, Leon. Okay. Everybody's tweeting now. Mm-hmm. In your old institution, Congress, before anybody's talked to their colleagues and tried to come to some compromise, people are out tweeting their views. And now everybody's locked into a position. So social media is challenging to democracy, quite apart from the president, is challenging to democracy because democracy takes time. You have to have time to talk, to compromise, to think, to find interest overlap. And if the first thing you do is out there with your first thoughts, you've got a problem. So I think social media is challenging in general, not just with the president's tweeting.
Ash, tweeting.
Well, it is unprecedented. And that by itself, I don't think would be a problem, though I completely agree with Condi that it is such a shorthand form that it's hard to have a complete thought within it in that format. But the real issue comes when there is a discrepancy in between what the president has said and what some other official has said, or what has been said and what is done. And how do people react to that? I see them reacting around the world, and they ask me this question all the time. And there are two ways it can go. One is to discount what the president tweets or says, and the other is to discount what America seems to be doing or what other officials are doing. Neither of those is good for us. And so the consistency is really essential to having a policy of purpose. And I noticed the financial markets have, at the beginning of the administration, they would react to the president's tweets. But as the months went by, they have ceased to do that, and they simply discount them. And so that's people who listen and judge for a living doing that. I wouldn't like to see that occur in the foreign policy area. on either side. I don't want them discounting what the president says. I don't want them discounting what all his officials said and what the policy appears to be on the ground. So you've this question of clarity and consistency is something that every new administration has. This is a particularly serious case of it, both because of the tweeting and just in the nature of things. But we're not going to get what we need to get from our foreign policy if we can't be clear and consistent.
Yeah, I think we can all agree he needs a strong chief of staff.
He's available. He's available.
We're at the point where we're going to turn to the questions from the audience. But again, I'd like to take a moment to recognize our question review team. These are the people who select the questions that will be presented to our speakers. And I'd ask you to hold your applause until I introduce them. Fran Gaver, who's our veteran question review team member. Doug McKnight, reporter from KAZU Radio. Claudia Melendez Salinas, who's the education reporter for the Monterey Herald. And Amy Wu, who is the government and political reporter for the Salinas, California. Would you thank them, please? And Sylvia and I, again, want to take this moment, along with the Panetta Institute Board of Directors, to say how grateful we are to all of our sponsors and supporters. As you know, we are celebrating our 20th anniversary this year, and this achievement, frankly, would not be possible without your help. So please give sponsors and supporters a hand, too, for their help.